You have no promises as yet. The subject this morning seems to me to have a great deal of special significance for those who are seeking a reunion or a revival of the integrities of learning in their own lives. We're not thinking primarily now of the great world outside, but of the impact of outside pressures upon ourselves. In the modern world, we have two highly conflicting structures of learning. The first and oldest is religion. The second and youngest is science. And these two, for some unknown reason, seem to be in constant conflict. The average scientist lives in a world that is nominally religious. The average religious person lives in a world that is nominally administered by science. And we have two very definite problems. Science deals with things visible. Therefore, the goal of science is facts. Religion deals with things invisible. And the goal of religion is truth. Is there really a conflict between truth and fact? Well, in ancient times, there was an arbitrator between these two extremes, and that arbitrator was philosophy. Philosophy was very largely a means of reconciling the visible and the invisible aspects of life. Science recognized and respected philosophy because it demonstrated a very clear intellectual and rational approach to all types of phenomena. Religion also respected philosophy and built a great part of it into its own structure, for it recognized that philosophy was also building a reasonable foundation under things unseen and invisible. Gradually, philosophy has lost the name of action. Generation after generation, science has flourished, religion has survived, and philosophy has limped along as a kind of intellectual cripple. Why this should happen is sometimes difficult to understand, but for one point, namely, that in our modern life, we draw to various fields of learning those who find in these fields opportunities for personal orientation, a measure of success, a measure of recognition, and a measure of reward. At this time, philosophy is not fashionable. It does not meet the general approval of the people. Science is venerated by the young, religion is sustaining the elder, and in between is nothing but industrialism. The philosophy that should guide us in the journey of life has lost its grip upon the popular imagination. Perhaps one of the reasons for this is that the modern philosophy, scholastically speaking, is indoctrinated in a system of education which is essentially materialistic. Therefore, what used to be the particular field and claim of philosophy has gradually drifted into a more restricted area called psychology. Several efforts have been made to combine philosophy and psychology, and some of these have had a fair measure of success, but with a few marked exceptions. Psychology itself is under the domination of science, and its techniques and procedures are largely scientific. Actually, there is no ground for reason for believing that religion and science are incompatible. We simply have to consider two areas in which these specializations function. The visible, tangible, physical universe is the province of science. Very few persons today have escaped from the hypnosis of materiality. To see something, to touch it, to hear it, to understand it from a scientific standpoint results in what the average individual considers to be fact. We are made to assume that physical things are factual. Metaphysical things are theoretical. And to the factualist, little better than superstitions. So in the search for the factual, we have locked ourselves within a complex which is almost unendurable. Facts are dead things for the most part. About all they can possibly contribute to our well-being is a greater measure of physical security or luxury or wealth. Actually, for most people, this is all they want. The average individual is not primarily concerned with the problems of his immortal soul. He is much more concerned with taxes and inflation. He lives in a world to which he has become at least partly adjusted. And in this world, physical things are all important. And any request or advice which would lure him away from the physical aspects of his existence is viewed with suspicion. What are we actually gaining, however, from all of this? We are locking ourselves in a three-dimensional world. We are locking ourselves in a world of effects. And we are denying even the existence of a world of causes. We are bound to a situation which worsens every day and is to a very large degree dominated by the scientific implementation of physical ambitions. By science, we have received the telephone, the automobile, the radio, and the television. And these, though great in themselves as scientific discoveries, have become the greatest nuisances in history. Whatever we try to do with these things is mediocre in the extreme. The telephone has become the vehicle of small talk for most cases. It has not fulfilled itself as an instrument for the communication of basic knowledge. The condition of radio and television is worse. And practically every advancement we have made in science has been frustrated because the uses made of it have been mediocre in the extreme. We have gained very little of actual progress from these conveniences. Science should be in a very definite position to estimate life in a far more comprehensive way than is its present policy. Science can reveal to us, and does reveal to us, a universe of exactitudes. a universe in which the mechanisms of existence transcend even the wildest imagination. We are in the midst of a mystery so magnificent and so inscrutable that the human mind is almost incapable of coping with it. Science, of all branches of learning, is in the best position to estimate the mystery of existence in terms of the material world in which we live. Science should and must finally accept one simple fact, that it cannot find the ultimate answer to anything. Science is working on a level bound above and below by the boundaries of matter. It cannot transcend matter, but it cannot discover in matter the causes of existence. So the scientist must deal with what has been termed secondary causes. These secondary causes are in substance effects. There is a secondary cause behind everything that exists in the material world. That secondary cause can be known because it represents not the answer to the question why, but to the question how. Secondary cause becomes to the scientific mind ultimate cause, or a substitute for it, beyond which the mind cannot go. Many scientists, however, are not satisfied with the present procedures. We are spending vast sums of money in the exploration of a three-dimensional area which we call the material existence. We can examine, measure, weigh, analyze everything that has a body. But bodies are effects, and the cause of them remains unknown. We can judge what an individual is, in part, by what he does. But why he does what he does is unknown to us. We grope for explanations, not for the conduct of the individual, but for the fact of his existence. He is. Entirely apart from his conduct, he has an existence. What this existence is, why he has it, what power fashioned it in space, and if it is an existence, where does it go? What is it doing? These questions are not easily answered. And day by day, the scientists are coming against a mysterious wall that is more difficult than the wall of China, and that is the wall which marks the boundary of matter as we know it. Science can have the hypothesis that matter simply goes on beyond our ability to recognize its existence, and that all things are material. But science cannot prove that material elements combining in any pattern for any reason can produce an Abraham Lincoln. We do not know the mystery that lies behind the form. We know what Lincoln looked like. We know his approximate height. We know the chemicals that made up his body. We know the span of years he lived. But these refer only to his material structure. That which is within it remains a mystery for which science has no adequate answer. Various ways have been used to try to explain this scientific problem. I remember many years ago I attended some lectures by Dr. William Wildon Carr at the University of London. He was a great Aristotelian, and out of his study of Aristotle, he came to the conclusion that existence is eternal, that everything goes on forever. It never had a beginning. It can never have an end. And all the various phenomena associated with existence must be regarded as eternal factors. They must be regarded as merely the constant repetition of processes by which the mingling of certain atoms and a combination of certain electrons produce in their way certain results. These combinations go on forever. There is no rhyme, rote, or reason in them. They are simply a mass of miscellaneous factors constantly in shifting relationships with each other. Well, this gets rid of one of our problems, but it seems to me it creates a worse one. It gets rid of the problem of how did it start, and also perhaps the problem of how the future is endless. But it leaves us completely in the dark as to the reason for existence. We have something that it was never fashioned, never ends, never organizes into anything meaningful, but continues to motivate its own motions and combinations forever. This, is, I think, is not demonstrable today, even in scientific terms, because one thing we do observe is that these commotions of factors are forever producing orderly sequences, and that these processes seem to be regulated by universal laws, which are inflexible and inevitable. So, Dr. Carr was a most genial and delightful old gentleman, but he did not really solve our problem very much or do much to help it. He simply got rid of beginning and end, and left what lies between without definition or meaning. Now, science is gradually waking up to some of these facts, but unfortunately, it has not the instruments with which to work on them. The scientist is not trained as far as creative imagination is concerned. He is not trained to seek for that which has not been known. He will seek for what has not been found, but not for what has not been known. To meet this situation, man, at the very beginning of his history, recognized that there was a form of knowledge which was not limited to matter and was concerned from the beginning of itself with the eternal quest for original cause, for the nature and purpose of life. Religion has always taken it for granted that life is purpose, that it has a reason and a meaning, that it was bestowed by a reasonable power, that it is the work of a creative, intelligent principle. On this basis, religion began to develop the moral and cultural life of the individual. And for thousands of years, culture has largely been a religious factor. It is religion that has given us love of beauty. It has ornamented the shrines and temples of the world with art, sculpturing, architectural models. It gave the stained glass windows to the great cathedrals and it gave the tall minarets to the mosque. Religion has always sought to reveal life as something essentially beautiful, meaningful, and it established canons of beauty, which declares that which is truly beautiful is according to the divine plan. To function in this world, then, religion had to take up the search for reality. It had to depart from the three-dimensional world of matter to the polydimensional world of consciousness. It sought to explore man not as a form animated by an energy, but as a being animated by an eternal life principle. The moment religion began to fashion itself, materialism was also born, because there was always the skeptic, and the skeptic has become today more or less the ruler of human thinking. The religious aspect of the matter was cultivated with a full realization that fact, as we know it materially, is simply not available. We have mostly an agreement among scientists. A Chinese scientist trained in Germany or a German scientist trained in Italy will have approximately the same instruments with which to approach a problem of knowledge. Science on its own level has reached a fraternity, and this fraternity has been in many ways useful, but it has been a fraternity based upon the limitations placed by scientific procedure upon the extent and expansion of knowledge. Realizing that it cannot compete with the fact, that it cannot produce the popular phenomenon which we call progress, religion had to try to find out if there is a way by which the human being can discover the reason for himself. Science says there's not much reason to it, and this, of course, is sometimes demonstrable. But at the same time, there is something inside of the human being that certainly is not to be ignored. How then can you do this? How can you reach into this? Between the two extremes, philosophy took its stand. Philosophy accepts, and has in many instances advanced science, and many of the greatest discoveries of science were first revealed by philosophy. On the other hand, philosophy definitely believed in the substance of things unseen. Philosophy tried to bestow upon man a reasonable account of that part of his life which science cannot rationalize. So from philosophy in its highest form came idealism, morality, and ethics. Morality and ethics are not essentially religious in the theological sense of the word. They are merely a formalization of the experience of the human being since the beginning of his existence. Morality and ethics have been demonstrated as the basis of an enduring social situation or policy. Philosophy also expanded our concept of the universe. It brought into play another kind of world, the world of mind, a world which is not primarily assuming material things, but a world which lives within itself, the mind as the nourisher of itself, the mind as the seeker after eternal value. The ancient rites and mysteries of religion were very largely, therefore, the result of a partnership between idealistic philosophy and theology, and both are still to be found in close association in practically all of the living religions of mankind. having come to a realization that you cannot use a telescope to discover the human soul, coming finally also to the full understanding of the fact that a scientist can invent a hydrogen bomb, but he cannot bring security to the inner life of an individual. In fact, many of his contributions contribute to insecurity. So there is a different level, but that both levels are valid. Today, the scientist has a tendency to look down his nose at the theologian, and religiously minded people sniff rather disdainfully at the thought of science. But actually, there is no conflict, because each has an essential sphere of its own. How do we find out about those things which cannot be found in a laboratory or cannot be discovered by mathematical formulas or will resist all examination of their essential natures, as in a case of autopsy, which can examine the body, but in the very process of examination destroys the soul. So in the search for an answer to these questions, there are two answers, apparently. One scientific and the other mystical. The scientific answer can be that the scientist, in his continual searching into matter, can transcend matter. Science is in a position, from its understanding of the exactitudes of procedures in nature, to come to the realization that the material things he studies are secondary causes, but that each secondary cause depends for its validity upon a primary cause. It should be extremely simple for the average scientist to realize that what he is studying is an effect, and that he cannot, by virtue of his own instrumentation and the quality of it, discover the cause of that effect. He knows that things live. He studies living things. But he cannot approach life that is not embodied. He cannot discover life without its involvement in matter. This leads to the almost inevitable question that how can any matter exist except because of life within it? Even the most materialistic scientist realizes that life and energy exist in the most minute particles of matter. But they have not been able to analyze and advance this cause because they have no way of estimating the original source of life, the original purpose of life, and the original structure of life itself apart from its manifestations. This brings us back again to the problem of religion. How is religion going to discover that which science cannot discover? How can the average person, who is scarcely to be regarded as a scientific expert, how is an average person going to discover that which science cannot find and which theology, for the most part, cannot define? It becomes a very abstract situation. And many good minds and very wise people have tried to understand this mystery. And for the most part, it has summed up to the simple fact that man, being a living thing, has as a living thing the only instrument by means of which the nature of life can be understood. Man can understand it because he is alive. And because he is alive, he has the potential capacity of knowing what life is. This possibility seems to imply that universal energy, what we call the living universe, that this living universe is an ensouled body, and that this ensouled body can be explored by that part of itself which is ensouled in man. It can find that which is itself in each of its creations. This carries with it a series of problems, and the ancients tried to solve these problems. It opposed science with faith. It assumed that a kind of believing, strengthened from the inner resources of spiritual insight, can supply a strength of purpose capable of withstanding the pressures of a materialistic way of life. In ancient times, the problem was therefore to build an instrument within man himself by which he could become aware of the cause of himself. Now, many have held that this is only a kind of egotism, that the mystics were trying only to save themselves, but this is not true any more than it is fair to say that the average scientist or educator is primarily concerned with saving himself. The actual reason for the mystic was not that he might become nobler than somebody else. It was that he might help to perfect a structure which would be capable of leading humanity into a new relationship with reality. He was not working for himself, but working for the common good. But as all arts and sciences have had inventors, those who began the labor, and then this beginning was passed to others, so the mystics have had their inventors, have had their sources, and they honor these sources, as a scientist honors a great name in science. But this does not mean that these sources were motivated by self-interest, unless you spell the self with a capital S, for they represent the individual trying to fulfill the purpose for which he was intended, namely that he might become an enlightened and complete being of service to the universe and to his fellow creature. The search for these realities called immediately upon the person. And if we study and analyze all kinds of people in all kinds of places, we come to the realization, inevitably, that capacities differ, that specializations and aptitudes differ. But one thing the mystics found in the beginning, and which I think has never been disproved, is that there is a potential in each human being that is greater than the use he has made of that potential up to the present time. In other words, he is better than he knows himself to be. He has more value than he realizes. He has more possibilities than he has ever sensed or experienced. Now, of course, when you start telling him this, you may find he becomes a rather arrogant character. He begins to be too proud of himself, and becoming very aware of his own potential, he struts about with it but does nothing to develop it. This means that he has mistaken the basic idea. He has failed to recognize that a potential, in order to be changed into a potency, must go through some form of specialized training. This is no way different from any other branch of learning. Your scientist is a man of trained mind. He is a graduate of some institute that specialized in the things that concern him. He has spent many, many years learning to understand the field of his own specialization. During this time, he very likely has largely neglected to develop the field of his own character. He has become immersed in a subject, and this subject has taken over. And in this subject, he is a dedicated person, but at the same time, his own private affairs may go to pieces. In the same general thinking, then, there is no reason why we should assume that a philosopher does not require training, or that a mystic does not require discipline. We have every reason to assume that in order to attain the highest phase of genius in any area, it is necessary to release potential. And that type of mind or emotion or soul that has released the most of its own potential is the one that advances most rapidly in its chosen pursuits. So the mystics tried to find a way. They postulated an upper hemisphere that rose above the pinnacles of matter, that the material hemisphere was the lower, the spiritual hemisphere was the higher, and that this spiritual hemisphere was just as rich in mysteries, just as rich in natural resources, just as abundant in all values as the material world, and in many ways completely transcended matter. Because in some manner or way, all life comes from this upper hemisphere. Souls and spirits fall as a gentle dew from heaven. Everything comes from the above, descends into the below, lingers for a time, and then returns to the above from which it came. This cycle has been recognized always. But trying to make it into something practical and useful has been the great question. Theology, it seems to me, also has one valid point, which perhaps gives justification for its sense of importance. Whatever be the nature of life, unless the individual at death ceases utterly, forever, that which survives death must have an existence apart from matter. And if we are to consider the phenomena of life around us, it would seem that a considerable part of the life of every living thing is lived outside of body. If we believe in reincarnation, we realize the interval between lives, the individual exists, but he is not embodied as we know it. If there is survival of consciousness, and there is some universal heaven toward which all things proceed, then survival in that heaven will be infinitely longer than survival here on earth. If the individual survives, he should devote some attention to his condition outside of body. His existence in body is brief, and it becomes more hazardous every day. Therefore, to give oneself entirely to a way of life which must inevitably end is, it seems, short-sighted. If we could guarantee that there is no life beyond this, then the individual might be forgiven for living as highly as he can while he's here. But this is not demonstrable. We have no proof of this whatever. And if the scientific materialist insists that we have no afterlife, he can no more prove it than the theologian can physically prove the existence of an afterlife. Both of these points of view are hypothetical. And of these two hypotheses, which is the most useful? Is it better to believe or not to believe? Is a cynic or a skeptic a better person? Is the world a better person for unbelieving? There seems grave doubt as to this. It would appear from the whole record of history that the belief in the survival of life after death is one of the most important concepts of which the human mind is capable, and has brought more security, hope, and discipline to human thinking than any other form of belief. So the most useful belief is the reality of a spiritual existence. This is perhaps well demonstrated in the constant struggle today to keep religion alive, and the fact that it is gaining rapidly, religion increasing in importance as physical securities diminish. If this is a rule, then when the physical securities of a human life diminish, and at the end of this mortal existence, these securities have diminished completely, then the individual is dependent upon his internal values to sustain him beyond the physical structure of mortality. So the practical thing, which perhaps is more important than a scientific thing. We think always of science as practical. But actually, we have little proof of it, because science has contributed so many disasters that we might doubt how practical it really is. The most practical thing, or belief, is that by which we most advance the dignity of the human race, by which we most advance the great causes of civilization and principles and purposes, love of beauty, friendship, peace, understanding. These are the great values. And these values arise not from material science, but rather from the inner life of the person. They arise in those who have accepted the reality of a divine plan. It has always been a question as to how some of these various teachings have been disseminated. What proof have we that the prophet spoke truly? What proof have we that the Lord was with Moses? What proof have we that the sacred books of the world were written under some form of divine inspiration or guidance? And what proof have we, or can we bestow, upon the modern mystic who, living according to his inner convictions, has experiences which others do not have? How can he prove these experiences to those who have not had them? The simple answer is he can't. And the same is true of practically all religious phenomena. Religion is a highly personal thing. It can convert only the individual who accepts it. It can bring a religious consolation only to those who believe it. And this consolation cannot be transmitted to another person.